Well, we spent quite some time looking at the life of Jacob. It's not over yet, of course. He's living in the Promised Land, having returned there after a 20-year period serving his uncle Laban. But we depart from Jacob for this chapter, 36, to consider his brother, and then from chapter 37, almost to the very end of the book, the focus falls upon Jacob's son Joseph. Jacob and Esau really demonstrate to us that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who believe in God and walk with God. And there are those who don't walk with God. Notice I didn't say they don't believe in God. They may well believe in God, but they don't walk with God. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind whatsoever that Esau believed in God. But he didn't walk with God. Now, before we get into really what I want to say from this 36th chapter, there are three things that I want to clear up. Firstly, a confusion that you might have in your mind. Probably you don't, but just in case you do. Esau's wives are mentioned here. Ada, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibeon, the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter. Now, those names are different from the names that are given earlier in the story. We know that Esau had two wives of the land of Canaan, and we know that he married the daughter of Ishmael. But the names that were given in the other couple of references earlier in the book are different. Now, why would that be? And the most convincing explanation that I've read is that there was probably simply a change of name. That they may initially have been known by their family names, and they were given new names when they got married. Well, that kind of happens with us, doesn't it? Where a wife will take on her husband's surname. So it's that kind of thing that is happening, which would explain why these names are different here in chapter 36 from what they are earlier in this book. So there's just a matter of confusion that you may have had. Then, in the second place, a contradiction that you may see. If you've been following through this series with us, you may recall that Jacob, on his return from Paddan Aram, on his way to Canaan, sent messengers to his brother. He desired reconciliation with his brother. The last time that he and his brother had encountered, well, they hadn't really encountered, Jacob was running away for his life. Esau had threatened to kill him. And so Jacob now desires a reconciliation with his brother, and he sends some of his servants. And his brother at that time is living in Seir. But here we're told that he moves from Canaan, verse 6, to Seir, verse 8. Isn't he already living in Seir? It seems to be a contradiction. Well, the most natural explanation is that, yes, Esau was living in Seir, but that he had returned to Canaan. After all, at the very end of chapter 35, we read that Isaac, the father of Esau and Jacob, died. And his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. Now, they didn't live in the days of morgues with cool rooms to prolong a decaying body from becoming too decayed before burial. They were living in a reasonably hot climate. For Esau and Jacob to both together have buried their father would have necessitated Esau being in Canaan, not in Seir, some day's journey away at the very least. So it would seem most natural that when Jacob returned from Paddan Aram, at some point after that, Esau has come back to Canaan from his sojourn in Seir. After all, these were nomadic people. They were a people who moved around. And so it doesn't come as a surprise then that Esau would have spent some time in one place and then come back to this place and been there when his father died. So that solves that apparent contradiction. And then within this chapter itself, there seems to be a repetition. Some of those names, as badly as I pronounce them, you would nevertheless have recognized as being repeated in different parts of these lists. How do we account for that? Well, in the first place, verses 2 through 4, or through 5 rather, provide us with a list of the sons of Esau by these three wives that he had from Canaan. And then we have another list of the generations of Esau, beginning in verse 9 through verse 14. And that's a more general and broader list of the descendants of Esau, not fixed and particularly associated with those initial three wives. It would seem that he took other wives as well. And then we have other lists. We have in verse 15 a list beginning, these are the chiefs of the sons of Esau. Probably it would be better to say these are the clans. And so what is being described here is not so much individuals as kind of like tribal groups. Just as the descendants of Jacob themselves from the sons of Jacob will become tribes of Israel, so similarly the descendants of Esau. And then in verse 20 we have another list. These are the sons of Seir the Horite, the inhabitants of the land. And there, from verse 20 through verse 30, there is a description of the peoples who initially inhabited the land of Seir. That's the land where Esau moves to. It's a land that he eventually takes over. And there's a mingling then of the sons of Seir with the sons of Esau within the land of Seir, which will also be known as the land of Edom. And then in verse 31 and following, we have a list of kings who reigned in the land of Edom. And we have a history of the kings, beginning with Bela, the son of Beor, and continuing through as one king died, another took over. So we have a history of the monarchs of this region. And then finally in verses 40 through 43 we have a kind of a summary that represents to us the various regions with their chief characters, their chief individuals. So these are describing for us the regions of this land of Esau, in a similar way to the way that later on, as the Israelites settle in the promised land, it will be divided up geographically according to their tribes, and each region will be known by the name of its tribe. So it's a similar kind of description that is happening here. Now, I've mentioned a number of times similarities between Esau and his descendants, and Jacob and his descendants. But you know, there are huge differences. There are enormous differences. Did you notice through this reading of chapter 36 how the word Edom repeats itself over and over and over again? Do you remember where the word Edom comes from? Well, if you cast your minds back to the time when Esau and Jacob were young men, and Esau had been hunting in the field, and he came back on one of those rare occasions, perhaps, when he had failed to get anything, and he was starving hungry. And he says to his brother, "Give me some of that stew that you're cooking." Well, there we have it in chapter 25. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted." And we're told, therefore, his name was called Edom. But that isn't where that little episode ended, was it? Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. What is the use of a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Edom, red stuff. And forever after, Esau is known by that name. It characterizes him for the rest of his life, and not just for the rest of his life either, but those who follow from him, his descendants, become known as Edomites. It wasn't something to be proud of, that episode. He had despised his birthright, something that was a tremendously precious thing. So that the New Testament describes Esau as an unholy man, because of his attitude with regard to the birthright, which in itself displayed his attitude towards God. Esau was a man of the earth. So much so that it went far beyond his ruggedness and strength and success as a hunter. His whole view of life was anchored in the earth. He had no spiritual awareness at all, it seems. He lived for the moment. He lived for the chase of the game. He lived for the pleasures of his wives. He lived for life. But he didn't see the significance of the spiritual. The birthright was nothing to him. He exaggerates his condition. I'm famished. I'm about to die. What use is a birthright to me? When bread and lentil soup satisfied him, a meal gobbled down in a few minutes satisfied him, he wasn't on his deathbed, not by a long shot. But look at his view of more significant things than the moment. He was a man who lived for the moment. We see it in that episode. We see it too in his choice of wives. He wanted a wife, he went out and he got a wife. Just like he wanted to eat, he went out and got something to eat. He needed immediate satisfaction, so he went where he was, which was Canaan, and he got for himself a wife. Well, actually, he got two. And then a little later on, when he sees that his parents aren't entirely happy with his choice of wives from the Canaanites, whom his grandfather had indicated were completely unsuitable as marriage partners for his descendants. Having seen that they had brought tension into the home, and seeing how they were pleased to be able to send Jacob, their other son, to find a wife from their family in a far distant place, Esau then immediately decides to take another wife to try and please his parents. And so he takes a wife from his uncle Ishmael. Well, half-uncle anyway. A relative? Well, what kind of a relative? The son of a bondwoman who had been paid off so that he would have no claim upon the inheritance of his brother. Separated, cast out from the covenant community. It was really no better. But he wasn't willing to make a journey because he wanted his parents' approval now, at this moment. Furthermore, when the land of Canaan seemed to be too small, and that in itself is questionable, considering that just a few passages earlier, the people of the region had been saying, well, there's plenty of room for Jacob and his possessions and all of our possessions as well. But when he felt that things were getting a bit crowded, he goes off to a far region, a region outside the land of promise. Another demonstration of the fact that he had no spiritual awareness at all. He had no understanding of God's call upon his grandfather Abraham and the risks that Abraham had undergone in order to bring his family to this land of promise. In all of these ways, we see that Esau, he despised everything that God had given. And what was the result? What was the result of Esau's despising all these things that God had given? Failure? Poverty? Destruction? Nope. None of the above. In fact, while Jacob's descendants, as we will see over the following chapters, as Jacob's descendants experience severe famine that leads them to exile in a foreign land and ends in slavery in that land, while Jacob's descendants experience all of that, Esau's descendants prosper. Esau's descendants prevail and become the dominant people in the region to which they move. Esau's descendants have kings reigning long before Israel. Isn't that interesting? That the people of the promise, the recipients of the birthright and the blessing, endure such enormous hardship. While those who have despised the birthright, squandered the blessing, and removed themselves from the land of promise, prosper. It hardly seems fair, does it? It hardly seems right. This isn't the way the story should work. Well, that's not the way it ends. You see, eventually, a despised birthright leads to a despised brotherhood. The descendants of Jacob become the enemies of the descendants of Esau. About half a millennium, 500 years will pass between this point in the history of Jacob and Esau and when Moses pens these accounts. And Moses pens these accounts on their journey to the promised land from Egypt. He pens these words possibly even after an encounter with the descendants of Esau. When on the route that they were taking, they would need to pass through the country of the Edomites. Moses requested safe passage, and they were refused. Well, that's one thing, I guess. That's not a happy conclusion, but things get worse. A few more centuries pass. The Israelites have settled the land of promise. Kings at last have come to a throne in Israel. The land has been incredibly prosperous under the reigns of David and Solomon. And then, of course, there's the tragedy of the divided kingdoms, of the idol worship, of the bad kings and the few good kings who try to bring some measure of reformation. And then eventually there's the Babylonian conflict that will lead to the captivity of the Israelites in Babylon for 70 years during the period of Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego and of Esther and her uncle Mordecai and so forth. As Nebuchadnezzar came in surrounding Jerusalem and preparing to ransack that city, some of the Israelites quite naturally fled, as you would do. And they fled across the Jordan, and they fled towards the country of Seir, where their brothers, the Edomites, lived. Obadiah talks about it in his book. Obadiah is a prophecy against the Edomites because of the way they treated their brothers. What did they do? Well, they slaughtered them as they sought safety. They captured them and handed them back over to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. The despised birthright eventually has led to a despised brotherhood. But you see, the story doesn't even end there. A few more hundred years pass, and shepherds looking after their sheep on a hillside suddenly are accosted by a huge number of angels in the sky singing the praises of God and announcing the birth of the baby in Bethlehem. Far away in the east, some wise men, astrologers, have noticed a special star and have surmised that this means the birth of a king, and have followed it. And they appear in Jerusalem, seeking it out. Oh yes, a king has been born. The son of David has come. The longed for Christ has appeared. Oh, but there's already a king in Jerusalem. Herod the Great is there. He's not too enamoured by the idea of another king being born, despite the fact that by the time this baby is old enough to take the throne, Herod the Great will be long gone anyway. But he hates the idea with a passion, so much so that he determines to exterminate all the baby boys of Bethlehem. Herod the Great was an Edomite. And this Edomite king was determined to get rid of the Davidic king, to get rid of the King of Kings. And it all started with some stew. What privileges had been Esau's? The grandson of Abraham and Sarah, growing up with the stories of their pilgrimage from Ur of the Chaldeans, the ways that God had called and God had protected and God had provided and God had prospered and God had brought and settled them here. Son of Isaac, who himself had in remarkable ways been provided for by God. And he despised it all. And that mark, the mark of Edom, the mark of the red stew, was upon his descendants for hundreds, thousands of years. Now there's an interesting story for you. But so what? What difference does it make? Well, as I said right at the beginning, the story of Esau and Jacob is the story of two kinds of people. On the one hand, there are those who believe in God and walk with God. And on the other hand are those who do not walk with God. They may believe in God. They may have had all kinds of privileges in their past that ought to have led them not only to believe in God but also to walk with God, but they choose not to walk with God. They are too earthbound to recognize the spiritual dimension of their lives. They are too mortal to recognize immortality. They're too temporal to understand the eternal. And the question inevitably that everyone in this room must ask is, where do I fall? Which camp am I in? Which clan do I belong to? Which king do I serve? And it can be seen in the little decisions of life. What do you despise? What to you has little or no value? And what does your heart yearn for? What do you crave? What do your hands reach out and grasp? And the warning, of course, from this story is this. Firstly, do not despise the privileges that are yours. For almost everyone in this room this afternoon, you have the privilege of coming here week after week after week. And you hear the gospel week after week after week. You're warned of sin and judgment, of the reality of the hell and the wrath of God poured out upon sinners. You're told of the provision of that God out of love for this sinful world, the provision of a sacrifice, his own son. You're told of Jesus and his perfect life and his substitutionary death upon the cross in the place of all those who would trust in him. You have these privileges week after week after week. Do you despise them? Are they nothing to you? Would you actually prefer that you weren't here this evening? Do not ignore the spiritual reality of your lives by living for this world alone, for reaching out and grasping things that will satisfy for a moment but have no eternal worth. Better to die of starvation within a hand's reach of a mess of pottage than to lose the blessings of God's promises. And remember the promises of God. Now, Jacob believed in God and walked with God, but boy, did he stumble along the way. We've seen that and we'll see it again. He wasn't perfect, but he walked with God. Esau had no desire to walk with God, not even stumble along the way with God. Remember the promises of God. That while those who follow God and do his will may not prosper and do well in this world, they have an inheritance that can never lose its value in heaven. Do not be like Esau. Be like Jacob. A frail man, a failing man, but a following man.